are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast is Shubha Menon. She's the author of The Second Coming, a romantic fiction published by HarperCollins India, and Resilience, Stories of Muslim Women, published by Front Page Publications. A mental health advocate, she's also a peer support specialist. Shubha Menon recently dropped the copy from copywriter to focus on becoming a full-time author. Shubha, thank you for being a guest on the podcast. To kick off, why don't you tell us about your journey into advertising? How did you get there?
I sort of stumbled into it. I was always good at writing in school and college. And after college, typically, I didn't know what to do with myself. And my sister knew somebody in a large ad agency and told me to just go and meet her. So I did. And then the creative director gave me a copy test. And there were several other people there who also sat for their copy tests. But somehow the creative director, he liked mine the most. So he offered me a job. So before I even had, you know, time to consider other avenues in life, I had a job. And it was a very large and very well-known advertising agency. So everybody said, you'd be mad to say no to this job. So I took it up and then I could never get out.
The rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last time we met, both of us were working at Ogilvy and you had just written your first book. Yeah. And I call it Chick Lit, The Second Coming. That must have required a mindset change from distilling 1,000 words into 10. There you moved into a different direction altogether.
Yes, because you know how it is. We write headlines which are 4 to 5 words long. And here I had to write 60,000 words at least to finish a book. So when I started writing, I finished saying everything and what? It's like 2.5 pages. I really didn't know what more to write. So many times I would ask myself, I think the book is over, but then I've only got 3,000 words. But somehow I did it. I had earlier attended a lot of workshops on writing with a lot of good people, and that helped me.
But why did you decide to write a book? Was that book inside you and it's something that you'd been wanting to do for some time?
Actually, advertising, it is very limiting for a writer. I must have been looking for another avenue, another way to write, or something else to write. And I didn't really plan it. I used to work in an ad agency those days. And at lunchtime, my colleagues and I, all women, used to all sit and eat lunch together in one small room in the corner. I remember it so well. And the conversation every day would be about marriage is so boring and that client is so good looking and I wish I could have an affair with that client. And then I realized that all of us were in this age and stage where we had children, we were married. And I think all of us, except maybe one, had quite given up on ourselves in terms of put on weight. So there was so much of common things. But one thing that really stuck out for me was that how everybody's wanting that romance in their marriage and they're all missing it. And so this book started forming in my head that nobody writes about older women and their desires, and romance is only supposed to be for 18-year-old girls and boys. While everybody talks about marriage as to the thing that happens to you, but once it happens, you realize that it's not what I had signed up for. So nobody really had written, I felt, about the feelings of women like me and all my friends and their feelings. So I thought that it needs writing. So that's how I started writing the first book.
That's such an interesting story, Shubha. And this is so true that all of us, you know, when we are younger, we think, oh, by the time I'm 40 and I'm 50, I'm going to be a different person. But by the time you get to that age, you
you're not that different from when you were younger. And your aspirations and desires do not change. There's no fundamental change in your requirement for a little bit of romance and a little bit of excitement and adventure.
Yeah, but the problem is that the world thinks you've totally changed. For the world, because you're married and you have children, it's like there can't be any romance in this person. There can't be any desire for romance. This person's married, has a child, closed chapter. Even the married woman is looking for admiration. Even she wants compliments. She does want romance, and nobody acknowledges it, I felt.
Yeah.
Even the women themselves don't quite acknowledge it.
They don't want to openly talk about it. It's also a cultural thing.
Our lives have also become so mechanical in so many ways. Both husband and wife go off for work, come in the evening tired. There's things to be done at home. It's also a factor of how much time you spend with each other.
From chick lit to writing resilient stories of Muslim women and collaborating with Shabnam Hashmi, that is some pivot. Your thoughts on that?
I wasn't really trying to write. I'd written my book, Second Coming. And then I was actually planning to write my book on bipolar disorder, which is something that I'm doing now. And first, I took a break after the book, all its publicity and so many interviews. Shabnam runs an NGO called Anhad. And they have this very cultural side to them. And they would host these talks with wonderful people, you know. So if you went for the Anhad Baatcheet sessions, you could listen to Bollywood director or a Dhrupad singer or a Thumri singer or a Sufi Kathak dancer or a syncretic music exponent. All kinds of wonderful people would come week after week. And I kind of started going because of a friend who told me about these sessions. Because I would keep going there very regularly, I got to know Shabnam a little. She knew I had written my first book and given her a copy, which she really enjoyed. She said that there is this book I want written, and would you like to write it? She said it was about these girls who had studied in her school, which she used to run, and she wanted to document their stories. Initially, I thought that this is some kind of academic thing, and me being a different kind of writer, I thought, it's not going to work. I was just dilly-dallying. One day, she called me. She said, come and meet the girls, 40-ish women. And I remember there was this bright yellow, huge table in Anhad. And these girls were sitting scattered around that table. And she had told me a little bit about them, you know, why she wanted their history documented. So I knew that they were girls from very poor backgrounds, very deprived, and how they had really struggled and come up in life and got some degree of success. But when I saw these girls, they were just girls. They were giggling away, and they all had these kajal in their eyes, with these dancing eyes they had. And none of them were wearing a burqa. I think only one was wearing a burqa. And they stared at me with so much frankness. And when we started talking, I found them totally opposite of what I had expected. I expected these women so full of their misery, but they were just so charming and so much fun. And there was no trace of having had some enormous struggle in their life or anything like that. And then I got talking to them, and I just thought that these girls are special and their stories must be told. Having overcome so much and still being so happy, that struck me as something which I needed to understand for myself and also bring their stories forward, because they are remarkable stories. So I'm very happy I took that on.
This is so poignant, because we often, you know, let our biases run away with us, and we form impressions and prejudices based on past experiences of what people should look like and what people should be doing. So how was it capturing their stories? Was it easy getting them to open up and talk about themselves?
When you read the book, you realize that because of the way Shabnam and her mother, how they taught these girls to break away from stereotypes. They don't have hang-ups. So getting them to open up and talk was not really a problem, except maybe with one or two. But then they were because of natural reticence. But these girls are bold, you know. They talk and they have opinions. They have points of view. That is the magic of what Shabnam managed to do with them. But I must say that On the other hand, I was full of biases. I remember when I first went to the Basti, and you know, I had never seen a place like that. Or if I had seen it like way back in my childhood when we had some relatives, you know, in the Chandni Chowk side, I remember once or twice going there. But even then, those were Hindu areas of Chandni Chowk. I've been to that Dargah before, Nizamuddin Dargah. Most people in Delhi, even vaguely culturally evolved, they've been to the Dargah to listen to Qawwali. So I had also been, but I had no clue that just a stone's throw away, there is this big urban slum. I didn't even know it exists. And if you look at maps, the Nizamuddin Basti is not mentioned. If you put it on Google Maps and you want to go there, it doesn't exist. So it's like one dirty secret, one urban slum hidden near the Dargah. So Dargah, everyone goes and that's it. No one goes further. But there are so many people living there. And so when I also first went to the Basti, and it was kind of, you know, dirty. There was heaps of garbage here and there. And the lanes were so narrow. So I was quite apprehensive. And I was following Shabnam like a little child, you know. So if I lose sight of her, I'll never find my way out of this warren. So I had more problems, I think, than they had. And I would go to the houses and I would check to see, you know, where to sit. I was so afraid that everything is going to be dirty. And if they offered me water or tea, I had a problem because I was so sure that, you know, it's not filtered. The water is not filtered. And if they offered me something to eat, I'd make all kinds of excuses, you know. But Shabnam had no such problem. Shabnam eating and drinking happily over there in everybody's homes. So I was the one who had hassles, not them.
We are so used to living a life that is far removed from the lives of people who live in urban slums. I think prejudice stops us from doing many things and engaging in more positive ways. But the good thing is that you did engage with them, and the result is resilient stories of Muslim women.
Yes. I'm so happy, and I discovered so many wonderful things about people. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's just people. It's not about Muslim or Hindu or rich or poor or slum or anything. It's just people. So I really learned that, and it was a very precious thing to learn.
That's such a insightful narrative, Shubha. Tell us, what is the next thing that you're going to be doing? So you've mentioned that you're going to be writing a book, but let's pass that. What are the other things that you're doing?
Oh, I'm always doing a million things. I don't know why. And just before I spoke to you, when we started this conversation, I was just finishing my exam. So I did a course on becoming a peer support specialist, a peer support specialist in mental health. So peer support specialists are people who have suffered through depression or bipolar disorder, and then how they can use the power of their story to help enable wellness in others. Apart from that, I organize most of the baatcheets that Anhad does. So all their cultural programs, I identify speakers and I get them to come and talk. And then about a year ago, they started talks on mental health. So I began moderating those. Of course, because of the pandemic, now we've been doing them online. We haven't managed to do too many, but we've done two or three which have been well received. Then the other thing which is a constant in my life is Buddhism. I practice Nichiren Buddhism, which is a Japanese form of Buddhism. But Buddhism is Buddhism, you know, it's all the same. So this is Buddhism for ordinary people and their daily life. That's how we define it. What else? I'm sure there are 10 other things I do.
Oh, that's a lot of things that you are doing. It's barely any time, and some very interesting things that you are doing. Shubha, moving on, I'm aware that you had a difficult childhood. How did that shape who you are today?
Can't say in entirety. From the state of hell, the way to the state of Buddhahood and Bodhisattvana, it's absolutely straight. You don't have to step into the other worlds. I don't know if I'm getting clear, but in Buddhism, they say there are 10 worlds and we keep swinging between those worlds, you know. So they are hell, hunger, anger, animality, then have rapture or heaven, then learning, realization, bodhisattva, buddhahood. Because only those who have been in hell can understand what another person in hell is going through. You understand?
Yeah.
So I think what it made me was very, very empathetic and very, very concerned about anybody and everybody. So I have this hypersensitivity to people, which gets me into trouble many times because I find myself constantly reaching out and, you know, doing for others before I do for myself. And that is not a good thing, you know, because self-care is equally important. And of course, they did very many negative things for me in the sense that I carried a lot of fear of all kinds. I quit two perfectly good jobs because I was too much in distress to be able to cope. But on the other hand, it also made me very, very resilient, you know. So yeah, it has shaped me into the person I am.
Self-care, empathy, resilience is also a word that we speak about often. And there may be an issue in being too resilient because you're constantly trying to live up to standards or to ideas about who you should be. And that is why you practice resilience. Resilience, when it is just about learning how to cope and bounce back, is different from expectation, the expectation of resilience that society, family, people place upon you.
Yes, that is a problem because many times when things go wrong, people say, oh, you will cope because, you know, you are so strong. But even strong people now and then need someone. No? But it's always taken for granted that you will cope.
Shubha, you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder in your 30s. Is this something you had suspected? And how did you feel? Vindicated, let down?
Actually, yeah, I was quite devastated. My mother was severely bipolar disorder, and that's how so much trauma got generated. Because for a child to have a mother who's completely not like other mothers and who is constantly turning to violence and self-harm, it's traumatic. It's very traumatic to grow up like that. And the one thing I always thought while growing up was that I am different. I'm not like her. I cannot be like her, what she did because of her past. But I didn't go through what she went through. So I was quite sure that nothing will happen to me. I had a brilliant, amazing, very loving father and a pretty steady home otherwise. And nothing did happen till I finished school and I finished college and I started working. And so I thought I'm safe. Nothing will happen to me. So then I went through a horrible, horrible depression. And the doctor I was seeing, he didn't give me any medicine. He said, he'll just therapy, he'll get me out of it. He couldn't, but he still wouldn't give me medicine. So the depression went away on his own after 6-8 months of terrible, terrible suffering. And I thought it's gone. It was a one-time thing. It won't come back, but it came right back. And then another doctor I went to, he gave me antidepressants. And again, I thought, I'm free now. I'm fine. But then it came back again. When it came back again, the doctor told me that, you know, I'm going to put you on a mood stabilizer because you have bipolar disorder. It's not just ordinary depression. You have bipolar disorder. And I looked at him and I told him, no, I don't have bipolar disorder. I cannot have bipolar disorder. I refuse to have bipolar disorder. I'm not taking any mood stabilizer, nothing. I'm going to be fine. You know, doctors just talk rubbish. But sure enough, you know, I had another episode and then there was no choice but to take it. I was miserable. I felt so cheated that all my life, I mean, I've suffered because of this illness because my mother had it. And now I have to suffer because I have it. So, I mean, it will never leave me. And this is going to be my life, just miserable all the time. So this is where Buddhism came in and saved me.
Interesting. What about the medicines? Did they help?
Yes, absolutely. The medicines really helped. I was put on a mood stabilizer, which really worked for me. And I was able to function quite well. Like nobody knew that I'm unwell. Nobody could even guess or think. And I was in advertising and I was doing late nights and late night scan. trigger episodes. I didn't know because I was quite illiterate. I mean, in terms of what is bipolar disorder, I didn't read up on it, nothing. I wanted to not look in that direction. I just want to pretend that I'm fine and this medicine I'm taking, it's keeping me completely fine. Nobody needs to know and I don't need to talk about it. So I went through like that for a long time. But only problem was that even with the mood stabilizer, I would keep dipping. I would keep getting into depressions in spite of it. And only after I encountered Buddhism and I started to chant, I found that steadiness, which allowed me, it's been like, what, 3.5 decades. I found that steadiness where instead of violent ups and downs, I'm steady with maybe small tiny blips here and there, you know, just little blips. And those blips, I kind of grin and bear those blips and life continues and I'm fine.
I'm glad to hear that. Considering there is so much taboo around mental health in India, did you speak to your friends and colleagues about what you were going through? And how did you cope? I mean, you've just told me about Buddhism, but in your workplace, were there things that were very difficult for you, but you just pretended and you got on with it?
Yeah. Firstly, I never spoke to anybody for the longest time. I just didn't. I didn't think people would understand. And I also felt that it would put a big question mark on my ability to work and cope. And everybody would view me with suspicion that, you know, can she even do the work? I didn't speak to anybody. In fact, so much so that I hardly spoke to even my sisters and brothers about it or my father. I just kind of kept it inside. I didn't speak to anybody. Though I did have difficulties. I remember, you know, in the initial years after I started lithium and before I became completely well, I had a lot of problems. I would go to work and there were times when I would just kind of freeze. Like if a brief was given to me, I was so sure that I cannot do this work. I started telling servicing people once or twice that don't brief me, I can't do the work. And once I had a big showdown because one guy said, what do you mean you can't do the work? I have a deadline, you bloody well do the work. And I said, I can't, I'm not capable of doing the work. So I would just kind of go to work and keep hoping against hope that nothing comes my way. And so I also suffered. So whereas other people got increments and promotions, I did not get because I was not able to perform. So yes, it was a problem. And things became so bad that, like I said, twice I had to quit the job. But if you ask me, it is Buddhism that saved me. But it is a huge stigma and nobody talks about it, though I feel that now, I think things have changed. Now people are somewhat open to talking about, like for instance, depression, everyone openly talks about now. So it has changed. At least in the urban upper class, there is a little more acceptance.
There is a little more acceptance we've seen around depression and around mental health, especially around students. And I guess a lot of it is to do with other people's problems and people are able to talk about it more when it is somebody else's problem. But when it becomes their own problem, they are less able to deal with it, cope with it, or take the necessary support or advice that is required for it.
I'll tell you something very, very, very nice. In Ogilvy, I used to sit in the same room with a girl called Preeti. One day, she and I discovered that we both have bipolar disorder. You know, so it happened because they were going to change our cabin. We were sharing a cabin and then some new people had joined and they were shuffling cabins. And they were going to put us in a cabin on the opposite side where there were no windows. And she said, hey, I have bipolar disorder. I need sunshine. I cannot sit in a room without a window. So I said, huh, you have bipolar disorder? Even I have. So, and the way she spoke about her, I have bipolar disorder. I said, she's so like cool about it. That was one big thing which made me also say that, okay, if she can do that, I can do this. And I actually wrote a mail to the head of the office and to the HR saying that there are two of us. We both have bipolar disorder. We need sunshine. You have to give us a cabin which has lots of sunshine and fresh air. And they did. So from her, I learned this, that you can talk about it. I have this phobia. I hate flying. If I can help it, I won't take a flight. And when I'm on a flight, I am like in shambles. And then I heard about this junior who's also very afraid of flying, but he had to go for a shoot. So he told everybody that I can't fly, I'm really frightened. And they booked him on a Rajdhani. And I'm telling myself, look at me, every time I have to go for a shoot, I'm like dying 1,000 deaths because I don't want to tell anybody that I have a problem. But look at this guy, he's so much better than me.
Acceptance and speaking up, I think, helps your cause a bit. But I guess younger people are also very aware about themselves, their issues, and they're happy to speak up. They're not worried about the same things that, I guess, you know, previous generations were.
I'm so happy.
That's some progress, at least. Shubha, what would your advice be to your younger self? There's so much you've seen. There's so much you've gone through. There's been so much learning.
My advice would be to love yourself. And whatever and however you are great. And there is no need to always be feeling that I need to do so much more or that, you know, I am so much worse. I can't do this. I don't have that. I'm not good looking. I'm not this. I'm not that. So I think I would really say that, you know, love yourself. I would tell my younger self that you're beautiful the way you are. Love yourself.
That's such great advice. What drives you every day, Shubha? And where do you find your sense of purpose?
I think it's again to do with Buddhism. Because in Buddhism, we are told that our purpose is to be happy and to make other people happy. So what drives me is if somebody I know is in distress, I have to reach out. Because if I don't, I'm not a Buddhist. Then I'm just living a pretend life. So that is a huge motivation for me. And I think writing is a big motivation for me. I feel a great sense of self. When I'm writing a book and I'm able to write in flow, like when I have the time to write for 3 hours, 4 hours in the day, it gives me a feeling of great, you know, everything's right in the world. So yeah, that drives me that I have to get up and I have to write.
Wow. This is the last question. Tell us a bit about your next project, which you had referred to earlier.
You mean the book?
Yes.
Okay. So my book, the working title is Jump. And when you read it only then you'll know why the working title is Jump. I may change it later. I haven't written much. I've written about 30,000 words.
Wow. That's some progress from the 2.5 pages.
Yeah. But, you know, I haven't been able to write because ever since this pandemic situation, I can't write at home. I find it very disturbing, you know, with two dogs and husband and daughter and maid and doorbell and all. Too much happening. So I was going away to a co-working space to write. And once the pandemic came and somebody in the co-working space got infected, I can't get out of the house. So, and in the house, I'm not able to write. And my daughter's getting married.
Wow.
Month.
Congratulations. Yeah. Well, in June.
In December.
In December. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Then there's no time.
There's no time to write. So anyway, I've decided that, you know, I'm going to take 1 month whenever it happens, like January or February. And I'm going to go away somewhere. I found a cabin in a forest. But the book is called Jump Right Now. And it's the story of my mother's illness. And how it impacted me. And so my relationship with my mother. And then how my daughter also got diagnosed with the same thing. And then my relationship with my daughter. And how much gloom and misery the first story is because my mother was untreated. Because the whole science of psychiatry is so new. That at her time, there was very little treatment available. And not just that, she didn't have caregivers. And how with my daughter, how I've been able to really give her the kind of care she needed and how I've been able to make her well. And so much, you know, sunshine and happiness in our relationship versus mine with my mother. I want to just bring out that contrast and show that, you know, everything is possible.
With intention and with the right kind of support. I guess everything is possible. I love the working title, Shubha, and I love the sound of the story because I think it's a story that needs to be told. People need to hear about this. People need to know that it's okay to speak about it and get the support and take medication. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's something terribly wrong with them and they can't live a fulfilling life because you are leading a fulfilling life and you have a great relationship with your daughter. So congratulations and all the best thank on you. That. And look forward to catching up soon again. And thank you so much for being on being a guest. I really enjoyed our conversation.
So did I.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.